April News now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And it's great to be back. I was took off a weekend and just traveled around over Thanksgiving. Very mm-hmm. pleasant time.
Did you stay local or did you go someplace?
No, we stayed local
mm-hmm.
and had a very nice time. But I missed all of our Tech Talk listeners.
Of course.
But, you know, we're back. We're back in the saddle.
Mm-hmm.
And this week, of course, the other shoe finally fell in the Apple Maps misfire.
Uh-huh.
Eddie Q fired the manager of Apple Maps, Richard Williamson, and of course Apple Maps has been under heavy criticism since Apple decided to drop Google Maps. But I have to tell you, when on my last trip, this last week I was down in Tampa, and I was in Jacksonville. The previous week I was in Charlotte and Atlanta, and I used the Apple Maps. And I actually thought they worked pretty well for me. You know, I was thinking these things are so bad, what's going on? But they're very convenient to use. I like the voice directions. I like the graphics on it. I think what happened was when they rushed to get it out, they were trying to put the coordinates on so many different features that they didn't zoom in enough when they were zooming in on the map. And if you don't
sure.
zoom in enough, you can place something off by half a mile if you're too far away.
Yeah.
And so I think it was a matter of data accuracy because they were trying to get so much done so quickly. They probably rolled it out too fast. But I think the basic software architecture is really pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually was thinking that I wouldn't like it. And now I use it all the time.
Well, I think my problem with it is that I just like Google Maps so much that it's tough to, you know, get with something else that could actually be better. That's...
Yeah, but the interface is so nice. So I'm sort of becoming a convert. And I didn't have any errors on my maps, at least down in that area. And then, of course, the big internet governance is coming on board. The telcos in Europe and a lot of the Arabian countries, Middle East countries, are teed off that people are bypassing their expensive cell phone and telephone charges by using the internet. And so now they're saying, well, actually, we should charge for any data coming into our country from other countries. So we want to charge for internet service, well, just like we charge for phone service.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that would pretty much kill the internet. And so they're trying to put proposals through the UN. There's this International Telegraphic Union, ITU, that actually creates global standards for telecom. And now ITU says, well, actually, we should control the internet. And I think that is a huge mistake. Can you imagine if the internet were controlled by the UN?
Yeah. They'd control everything else so well, right?
So I'll go through some of the politics there, who's behind it. It's an interesting development. Security is a big thing. China is still doing cyber espionage. And now I'll talk about some of the change in sort of policy where the U.S. is now looking at cyber activity as actually warfare or a form of aggression. And so now they're creating the cyber rules of warfare because they have to say, okay, when are you at war? What do you have right to do?
Mm-hmm.
What is illegal to do in this cyber warfare? So
sure.
they're trying to come up with ground rules for it because actually it is becoming an all-out war there on the internet. And which, you know, as an aside, it means there's great job opportunity for those of you that want to get into computer security. And, of course, it was a huge mailbag.
We've been having that a lot.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, we got a letter from Mrs. Claus. You know, Mrs. S. Claus.
Mrs. S. Claus,
yeah.
Right.
You know, dear Dr. Schertz, I'm getting ready to buy a new notebook laptop since I don't want to continue with my Windows XP operating system. You know, Santa Claus should have given her, you know, given her a better laptop sooner. I think it's, you know, it's.
Or she could have won one.
She could have won one. The what I would like to know, first of all, is there good free antivirus software that you'd recommend? I've currently been using ESET NOD 32, which I use that. I like it. But it's not free. And if there's a good free one, I'd like to know about it so I could use it. I'd also like to hear your recommendations about a place to buy online that's been recommended by my Power PC users group called Newegg. Is a good place to buy online. And once there, are you anywhere of sort of best practice on selecting a laptop? What I should get, what I should look at, and should I get a Windows 8 or should I hold back for Windows 7? What's your take on Windows 8? Because I'm very familiar with Windows 7, but not really Windows 8.
Mm-hmm.
Love the show, and happy holidays, Mrs. S. Claus.
That's high-level stuff there.
It's extremely high-level mm-hmm. stuff. So, you know, I put that email first.
I didn't realize that Mrs. S. Claus's name was Mary.
Yes, it is. That's her nickname.
That's actually breaking news. We have now revealed Mrs. Santa Claus's real first name.
Real first name mm-hmm. is Mary. That's right. Well, antivirus free from AVG is the best free antivirus software available. AVG Antivirus Free. It's a full-fledged antivirus and anti-spy tool. It includes email scanner, link scanner, scheduled scanning options, automatic updates, and more. There are a huge number of premium features. Premium means features you can buy.
Right, of course.
You don't understand that.
Premium means cash.
Yes, which would be frequency of updating, install it and forget it aspect of AVG's antivirus free really does make it the best free antivirus program available. Now, I still use NOD 32, but if you want a free one, AVG is the way to go. Now, as for purchasing a computer, Newegg does have a very good reputation online. You know, they've got a lot of happy campers. You'll find a few people that got unhappy because of the sales volume on Black Friday. There were things that showed that they were in stock, and they really weren't in stock, and people got totally teed over that. But by and large, if you look at literally tens of thousands of reviews, these guys are nearly five-star across the board. So mm-hmm. Newegg is really has very good reputation. It's a great place to buy online. They're not necessarily the lowest price. You could probably get better deals other places, and so you want to be very careful on where you shop. You can get some deals sometimes there's stock that they're trying to unload on TigerDirect.com, and I signed up for emails for there, and occasionally they'll get excess inventory and they'll unload laptops at really a great price. Huh. So I kind of like TigerDirect. If you want to get the cheapest deal, get last year's model. Because as soon as this year's model comes out, last year's model is cut in price by at least 40%. And it's really...
People think it's obsolete, but it's not.
It's not really obsolete. And since you're not a gamer, since I think you're probably more into just business software, mm-hmm. you don't need a screaming, you know, video card. And I think last year's model is going to be perfectly fine. So I'd look for last year's model. Now, that means if you're looking at a Windows machine, it's probably going to be a Windows 7. Now, Windows 8 is fine. Windows 8 was really designed for the consumer market, not for the business market. It's got a different interface. They tried to make it Apple-esque. And I don't think they necessarily, you know, accomplished that. But they did make a very robust operating system. It was one of the most extensively beta-tested operating systems out there. And for those people that sort of try to go through the learning curve to figure out how to use it, because it is a different approach than Windows 7, it's getting pretty good reviews. But the mm-hmm. features that they've added primarily are designed to support the consumer because they're going after the same consumer market that Apple's been going after forever. Now, as far as which kind of computer to get, okay, you've got to decide what you want. If you want a big screen for watching movies, it's going to weigh a ton. and you're not going to want to haul it around.
No.
So if you're using it kind of as a more of a desktop that you don't, you know, you don't put in a pack and fly off to India with, you know, a bigger screen would be okay. If you want to get a smaller screen, the whole system is going to be somewhat lighter, but you know, you won't have as much screen real estate to spread all the documents out that you're looking at. You also, if you want to consider weight, you could consider getting a solid straight drive. If you want to go to something ultra light, if you want to really go ultra light, you could just drop the CD like my laptop. I travel with it a lot, so I don't have a CD. I got a solid state drive.
Mm-hmm.
It weighs about 2.4 pounds, and it's very convenient to travel with. But I wouldn't necessarily choose that for a desktop. And then battery life. I mean, if you're going to be sitting out in Central Park all afternoon surfing the web, you're going to want battery life. That's
have
gonna
you
be...
done this before?
Never. I've never done that.
I mean, you're so specific about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I've never done that. But, you know, there are some people that,
sure,
that would like to go out there, and they'd like to, you know, sit with the birds flying around, go to the National Zoo and and work on their laptop. So in that case, you'd want a battery life that would be long enough. And so there's a trade-off between weight and battery life and size, and all of those play into cost. But you can probably get a good utilitarian laptop that's going to meet your needs for like $500-$600 quite easily, because the prices are coming down pretty dramatically. Great email from Miss Santa Claus.
You know,
Mrs. Santa Claus.
Santa Claus. You know, it's really funny. I never thought I'd say this, but the iPhone does almost everything I needed to do, including I can browse the web. The only thing I can't do on this thing is documents. It's the only thing I need a computer for.
Yeah,
isn't that crazy?
Yeah, once you have the iPhone, you really don't even need a computer to travel with.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
unless you're working on documents.
Unless you're working on documents, that's it. And you can actually get a keyboard with your iPhone if you'd want to sit there and get a keyboard, because it's got Bluetooth.
Mm-hmm.
So you could actually connect a Bluetooth keyboard to your iPhone.
Right.
And then you could prop your iPhone up, and then you'd have like a laptop with a really small screen.
Sure.
But you could do documents with it, with let's say a Docs to Go.
I may have to do that.
And then you can save your documents to, say,
the
Dropbox.
Yeah.
No, Dropbox.
Uh-huh.
So what you do is you save it to Dropbox, and then you synchronize the Dropbox folder on your iPhone with the Dropbox folder in your computer. So you save it to Dropbox on your iPhone, you log on to your computer, and it's there. It's there. And so
how much would it cost to buy a keyboard for an iPhone? What's it run?
I don't know. I've never really seriously looked into that.
Let me Google that while you're doing some other mailbag
but
stuff.
But make certain that the driver is built into the iPhone for the keyboard. So I'd have to do a little research on that, but well, you could
I'm
do that.
Do that
you could
while, do it
during
I'll do
the
that
break.
While you're doing what you're doing. Okay,
that's a great question. We got an email from James Messick. Dear Tech Talk, I was fortunate enough to score a Black Friday deal on an HD TV. I got a Vizio E601i-H3. The television has built-in apps to play Pandora and other streaming audio. It probably can also play Netflix and everything else. So, but his question is there any way to dim the screen while playing audio? This is more of an aesthetic issue than a burn-in issue. And as an side note, I'm also a cord cutter, so I'm using a $30 amplified antenna, and I receive all the major networks and PBS and other channels for free. Thanks, James Messick in Kernersville, North Carolina, obviously a podcast listener. Well, that is the problem with the TVs that include all the sound components within them. You've got to leave the TV on to get the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, I had an experience with one TV like that. And honestly, when you were running just sound, you got to leave the TV on. I've got the same issue if I'm listening to music over the cable. If you've just got a TV there for the sound, you've got to leave the TV on. Now, at home, I've got a component system, so I can listen to music on the cable, and I can go and I can turn off the television because I'm using the component amplifiers. But in your case, it's all built into the TV, and you can't really turn it off. Now, I did check. That would be a great feature for them to offer, that you could turn off the screen even though the amplifiers were on. And I checked, and I could not find any TV that would allow that. I especially looked at the Vizio, and I don't think you can do that with the Vizio. So I think you're pretty much stuck with that. But congratulations on your Black Friday deal.
Mm-hmm.
We got an email from Mary. Oh, Mary, dear Dr. Schertz, I have Verizon Fios, and I've read that Verizon configures my router with WEP security, WEP. That's called Wireless Equivalent Protocol, WEP security, and that it can easily be hacked. They recommend configuring my router with WPA2 encryption. Now, my router has a sticker on it that says MAC ID and WEP key. Can these be used for the router password? Seems like this protection stuff keeps growing in scope, and Verizon has no customer service worth a dang, so I don't know who to talk to. Thanks, Mary. Well, Mary, you actually are going to need a password for your router to change the encryption method. Now, what they have there is your WEP key, which of course what they've given you, and the MAC ID is the physical address of your router. So when they register your router with Verizon Fios, they call in and they say, okay, this MAC ID is now registered, and they will then authorize you to use the Fios network from that MAC ID. And then the WEP password is used so you can log into the wireless account. Unless you ask for it, the Verizon service installer is not going to give you the password to the router. Now, when my guy came, I said, I want the password to the router. And I immediately changed the password to one I could remember because the initial password was like this really complicated string of characters. So you're going to actually have to get the password to the router, and you can log into the router. The router has a built-in web page, and you simply go to the IP address, open up your browser, and go to 192.168.1.1, and that will open up the welcome page to your browser, and then it's going to ask for a username and password, and you're going to have to know that. So the username might be admin, and then there'll be some password. And so you're going to have to talk to Verizon to get that. Now, it is possible for you to press a button on your router which resets it to factory settings, but I wouldn't advise that because I think they've configured it specifically for the Fios network, and you would be unable to recreate the exact configuration that they have. So that would be a typical question. They may be able to log into your router and reset the password remotely. Now, let me explain about this encryption. It turns out WEP, Wireless Equivalent Protocol, is fairly easy to crack because the encryption key doesn't change. And you can sit there and just listen to a whole bunch of packets. And eventually, you can gather enough data that you can, in fact, compute the encryption key. And you can probably, if somebody's just, you know, surfing the web, you could probably listen to their network for a couple of hours, and then you could get enough data to calculate the key. And so WEP is very easily cracked, and there are a lot of open source tools out there. Now, that means that, you know, there's going to have to be somebody that wants to crack your network. It's going to sit outside your house and do this thing. So that means you'd have to, you know, it'd have to be a very intentional thing. Most people don't do enough with their computer with their wireless that even makes a difference. Now, it turns out that WPA2 solves this problem in that they rotate the key periodically. So they rotate to a new key before you've had enough time to accumulate enough packets to calculate the key. And so it takes an enormous amount of processing power to crack a WPA2 code. You could still do it if you had enough processing power because you have to process it fast enough to get the key before they change the key. So if you really are worried about somebody hacking your network, you would want to switch to WPA2. And so you'd have to log into your router. You have to go to the wireless section. Then you'd go to the encrypt and you'd select encryption. You'd select encryption type. WPA2, then you'd have to put in a key. But it's all going to start with you getting the username and password from Verizon, and so good luck with that. I've never gotten it from their help desk. I've never let the installer leave the house until I had it. We got an email from Lauren. Dear Dr. Schertz, I'm a member of a PC users group listserv, And some of the group and some members of the group have complained about how slow the internet response is and claim that the domain name server provided by the internet service provider is timing out. They speculate that this is a way to throttle down the traffic on the internet. They've suggested using an additional DNS domain name server. Some are using the Google OpenDNS at address 8.8.8.8 in addition to their list of DNS servers. I almost always feel that there's more I ought to be doing to have a stable, secure internet experience, but I don't possess the knowledge to put this kind of stuff in place. With your insights, perhaps you can improve my performance and security. Thanks much, faithful listener, and love the show, Lauren. Well, I'll give a couple of sidebars here. Domain name server, DNS. This is the thing that converts English names into binary addresses. So if you put in stratford.edu, that goes to a domain name server, and it sends back the IP address of stratford.edu. So you don't have to remember some string of numbers. So it makes addressing on the internet easy for people who read English. And so that domain name server simply provides that conversion. Now, if you're trying to access the internet and you put in a name that requires conversion to an address by going through a domain name server, the domain name server doesn't get back to you, you're not going to get on the internet. Now, if you knew the IP address of that site, you could put that in directly and go straight to it and bypass the DNS. Now, the DNS servers are, each internet service provider provides their own DNS for their clients. And when you log on there, you configure your network connection to say, give me the DNS server addresses automatically and sign my IP address automatically. And it does that. I doubt whether the internet service providers are using timeouts on DNS to throttle you, because they can simply log into your router and they can throttle you down directly. All the routers are set up to be very easily throttled. And in fact, when they configure it, it's throttled.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect they can simply log on to your router and they can adjust whatever speed you're going to have. They're not going to do it with INS with DNS timing. But having an open source DNF is not a bad idea. It gives you a backup, and so you could easily do that. And so if you would like to do that, what you can easily configure it. And what you're first of all going to have to do, you're going to have to figure out what the addresses are of your domain name servers that you're using, because you're going to have to manually put those in, and you're going to have to manually put in the open DNS server that you want. So you can go to the command window, just go to execute in Windows. There's something called run. Open up run and then type in CMD. That opens up the command window. Then you can just do ipconfig/all, and it'll list all your current IP configurations. Go down there and get the address that's currently being used for your domain name servers. Write that down. Then what you want to do is you want to right-click on your wireless connection. I have all these directions on the website. Right-click on the wireless network connection icon in the lower right-hand corner. Then click on Wireless Properties, and this will open the Wireless Network Connection Properties. Then you want to highlight the Internet Protocol version 4. Then you click on those properties. And then when that comes up, you click on Use the Following DNS Server Addresses. And, of course, at that point, you'd be unchecking automatically get the DNS server addresses. And so you put in the IP address provided by your ISP for DNS server. And then you add the IP address for the Google Open DNS. And that IP address is, of course, 8.8.8.8. Put that in, and then you can say OK. And then what will happen will be it will go to your ISP's domain name server. And if that's not available, it will just try the Google open source. So it's not a bad idea. Good, great question.
Sure.
Sorry for all those asides, but I had to explain.
It's necessary, yes.
It's necessary. We got an email from Jerry. Dear Dr. Schertz and Jim Russ, you've mentioned VMware numerous times recently and advised installing Linux side-by-side with Windows after first virtualizing with VMware. You also highlighted the founders of VMware recently. Ah, he's a listener. He knows that. Very good.
And you'd be the one mentioning it and not me, because you know way more than I do.
Yeah. Eager to try your suggestion, I went to the VMware site. There are lots of products. Some are a bit expensive for casual experimentation. Could you say a few words about which VM product you'd recommend and other non-VM brand virtual machine software? Love the show. I've been listening since 2002. formerly over the air in Germantown and now in Baltimore, and now exclusively through podcast. Thanks, Jerry.
Now, you know what? when he hears this on the podcast, you can get 1500 in Baltimore.
You can.
You can, absolutely.
Okay, Jerry, 1500
so, Jerry,
a.m.
Try that.
9 a.m.
That way
Saturday
you can be
morning.
Right on top and you have to wait for the podcast.
Yeah, but you know the trouble is I'm thinking, Jerry, parties Friday night.
Yeah.
I'm thinking he can't get up
probably.
Saturday morning.
That could
this
be
what
it.
Happens to my
it's
students.
Tough.
My students can only listen to the podcast because they say Saturday morning is just
it's
pretty
too
much
rough.
It's just really out of the question. Well, let me give you a couple of ideas here. I mean, they're actually kind of changing their pricing policy a little bit. You used to be able to download stuff free, and I'll show you how you can still do that. What they would like you to get would be the VMware Workstation. This would be the – and you can get a free 30-day trial, but then they want you to pay $249 to have a full-blown license, which I'm thinking for just experimentation is too expensive. You can get an academic license for $149, but that's only good for a year. Okay, but here's the deal. If you look for VMware Server, is free virtualization software from VMware. Now, although its support has ended this year, it's still available for download, and it's still free. VMware Server supports almost all the operating systems as guests or hosts, but 64-bit operating systems cannot be installed on a 32-bit host. Which makes sense. VMware Server is supported for USB devices and also supports bridged NAT. That'd be network address translation. So you can set it up as a router if you want, or it's a firewall to the internet, and it will host only network interfaces. So it's actually pretty good. So you can go to VM Server, and even though they say it's no longer supported, it's a great piece of software that you can learn on. So that's actually what our classes were using, but now they're trying to steer you to this VM workstation where they charge you $249. So that would be VM Server, and it's free. There's also another VM Server also comes with an administrative tools pack that can be installed from the file menu. The administrative tools make it easier to communicate between host and guest operating systems without locking the mouse. And the enabling of cut, copy, and paste, drag and drop operations across host and guest operating systems. You can go from operating system to operating system. Pretty nice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another option is VMware Player. Now, this is software that enables the user to create and run virtual machines on Windows or Linux PCs. VM Players can create virtual machines in addition to running virtual machines created by VMware Workstation. VMware actually is free for personal, not VMware Player is free for personal, non-commercial use. So if you're careful, you can get some pretty good. So I'd play around with the VMware Server. Even though it's not supported now, it's a great option to learn. And then VMware Player, you can also play around with that, and that is still free for non-commercial use. But great question, and thanks for listening.
Yep. Lots of great questions today. Doc, headphones back on. You're not finished.
Oh,
how
yeah.
do people send you an email?
Oh, yeah. We love your emails. Send your emails to techtalk@stratford.edu. And also, we're going to be monitoring you on Facebook. That would be facebook.com/techtalkonline, and we'll give your comments on the air.
Excellent. This is Tech Talk Radio on 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Stand by. More stuff coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to be talking about Ben Silberman. Ben Silberman is an American internet entrepreneur who co-founded and is CEO of Pinterest.
Which is a huge, big thing now, isn't
it? It's a social networking site, and everybody has like a bulletin board, and they pin pictures on it, pictures that they're interested in. So it's called Pinterest, like pinned interests.
Mm-hmm.
Pinterest. Silberman was born 1982 and raised in Des Moines, Iowa. He's a Midwest guy. His parents were both ophthalmologists with a family practice. Silberman was accepted into Yale and spent 2 years studying science classes, prepping for medical school entrance exams. I think his parents were kind of behind that.
Yeah, probably.
They said, you know, Ben, we want you to follow our direction in medicine.
That usually doesn't.
He changed his mind and decided that a career in business was the thing. So he spent the last year of college while he was working on his business degree applying for consulting jobs. Now, he graduated with Yale in 2003 with a political science major. Not exactly business.
No.
I don't know. There's kind of a disconnect there. Well,
yeah.
Maybe since he was in Iowa, he wanted to get into politics.
Maybe it'll all make sense by the time you get to the end here.
It could make sense, but I don't think political science has a darn thing to do with it.
Nope.
Business does. After graduation, because he, you know, was trying to apply for consulting jobs, he landed a job in the District of Columbia with the Corporate Executive Board, which was a business consultancy. He tried to consulting for a while. He tried to be a good consultant, but his interest drifted. He said, you know, this just isn't for me. So he said, Mom, Dad, I think I'm going to quit my job. This was the mid-2000s. He was reading all these blogs about these big rich guys getting rich with the internet, you know, blowing, you know, just expanding, Facebook, all the stuff that was going on. He says, I've got to get in that action. So he quit, and he and his girlfriend, but while they both quit their jobs, I think both parents were probably a little upset with that. And they moved west. At the end of 2006, he landed a job doing customer support for Google's advertising division, which was actually pretty impressive since he's not a technical guy. He must have been a smooth talker, but so he got into Google. He spent 2 years there at Google, and then he decided, no, this really isn't for me, and he set out on his own. And he decided to launch a product of his own. He launched it with a college friend, Paul Sciarra, and it was a shopping app called Tote. They raised a small amount of seed money, and they worked on this and worked on it, and I'm telling you, Tote did not take off. But it did reveal something very interesting. Rather than buy things with Tote, they used Tote as an app to send emails to themselves of products that they would like to buy later. So they started using Tote as a way to store pictures of things that they wanted, that they were interested in. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And this kind of struck a chord with Silberman. People kind of collect things that they want to, that they have an interest in, because as a boy, as a hobby, he liked to collect bugs, and he'd dry the bugs. You know how they put a pin through it, and they pin it to a cork board, and they put the name under it. So he was like into like pinning bugs on cork boards, and he had these little boxes, you know, shadow boxes. He put the bugs in, And so he's thinking, okay, people want to collect pictures. They want to put them on a bulletin board. And he says, hey, why don't we make Pinterest? Well, they can just put all the pictures they want to save for later reference on their own bulletin board. And so he sort of got the idea. Now, in the fall of 2009, Silberman met Evan Sharp. He was a Sharp programmer, actually. Evan Sharp. He was a student at Columbia's Graduate School of Architecture, and they started talking about digital collecting. See, and they both kind of had an interest in this. And so this one idea led to another, and it triggered the whole thing be involved in Pinterest. So the trio began working immediately. Sharp actually wrote the code that evolved into Pinterest, and what he did, he actually did most of his coding sitting in the Whole Foods store on the Upper West End of Manhattan, probably just using all their free Wi-Fi.
Exactly.
And drinking one cup of coffee the entire day. Actually, buying one cup and getting refills the entire day.
That's right. You can do that.
He's exactly the kind of customer that probably they didn't want to see. But out of that coding activity there at Whole Foods on the Upper West Side of Manhattan was born Pinterest. Now, Silberman and Sciarra worked from an apartment. They like to say a dingy apartment in Palo Alto.
Mm-hmm.
Sharp developed and coded nearly 50 working versions of the site. You know, usually you're going to do mock-ups and just graphics, but he actually made 50 working versions of the site, and they played with them. They experimented with column widths and layouts and ways of presenting pictures. And sort of that accelerated development cycle really helped operate the system. Now, when the site launched in March of 2010... Sharp dropped out of architecture school. Another pair of parents.
They were pleased.
Highly disappointed.
Uh-huh.
And he took a job at Facebook and moved to Palo Alto. He took the job at Facebook so he could pay the rent.
Sure.
Because Pinterest was paying nothing.
Uh-huh.
Silberman went out and raised VC money. He's kind of the marketing guy of them all. Now, in order to scale... So they started actually working the thing and getting a few users, getting more users. And, you know, in fact, in the beginning, they were having such time getting users that he went out to different – they personally invited different people who were designers to save pictures that they wanted. And then they made it very exclusive, invitation only. So you had to be a very, very excellent designer to even have the right to use Pinterest so they could get people posting their designs. They did not want it to turn into a repository of thousands of vacation photos like Facebook had become. They wanted it to become something different than that, something that you were really collecting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that initial thing really worked. In the beginning, just to get customers, he used to give customers his cell phone number. You know, and give them help.
Yeah,
I mean they were trying to bootstrap this thing because in the beginning they didn't get much interest.
Well, one way to build loyalty, right?
And he just kept on it, and he finally built it up. Now, in order to scale, he knew that he'd have to have mobile apps. So this summer, this summer of 2012, he had what he called the summer of the app, and they locked down Pinterest for 35 days. And they wouldn't let the programmers go home. I mean, they just brought in pizza. They just coded 24/7, and they came out with the iPhone, the iPad, and the Android mobile systems that allowed them to continue to scale. He was not going to make the same mistake that Mark Zuckerberg made at mm-hmm. Facebook, mm-hmm. where he didn't put mobile first. Now, in January of 2010, Pinterest surpassed 10 million monthly unique visitors, which is a pretty good thing. But just to give you an indication of how fast it's growing, by April of this year, let me see, January, February, March, April, that's 4 months later, it had doubled to 20 million a month. I mean, that's a steep curve here. Now, nearly 80% of Pinterest users are women, mostly between the ages of 25 and 54. Now, here's the idea. So suppose a woman is, say, you know, she sees a dress that she likes, but she's not really, so she just, you know, puts that on her wardrobe, she copies a picture of that and pins it to her wardrobe bulletin board.
Mm-hmm.
And then she gradually has all these different pictures up there of wardrobes and dresses that she likes. She may have another, you know, another bulletin board would just say purses. Or maybe somebody's planning a wedding. They'll just put all kinds of wedding pictures up there.
Sure.
And so now, the reason this thing is pretty interesting is that actually people are using Pinterest with the objective of buying ultimately. So that means it's going to be a lot easier to monetize.
Sure, sure.
So Silberman recently hired Tim Kendall, the engineer. He's an engineer and is with a Stanford MBA. Kendall is credited with creating Facebook's monetization strategy in 2006. And we know that there's going to be monetization coming along because there are some of the heavily followed Pinterest users where companies are paying them up to $1,500 to $2,000 to pin one of their products on their bulletin board. So we know that vendors are tracking this. I think he's going to be able to monetize this really well. Right now, they're getting zero revenue.
No, it's pretty simple. I mean, somebody's pinning up clothes that they want to buy. Pinterest goes through, finds this stuff, and they, you know, and you get a banner ad from J. Crew or whatever, right?
I mean, it turns out that the social networking piece is pretty neat. Suppose that some guy is trying to look for a gift for his girlfriend. I mean, it's hard to search on Amazon and all, mm-hmm. but if you search on Pinterest, you might find some guy or you might find some girl that lists all of the gifts that she would like to receive. So all of a sudden, you've got sort of gifts that are kind of recommended.
Yeah.
And it's actually a better way to search for gift ideas when you don't know what you're doing. And so Pinterest has become kind of a social networking shopping application. And that's why it's going to be very easy to monetize.
Why do you think this is so much bigger with women than with men?
Because it's just women. I mean, men don't really think about shopping and gathering.
They wouldn't put up pictures of all the beef jerky they want.
No, women are more gatherers and men are more hunters. So if a man wants a suit, he's not going to sit there on the internet and save pictures of suits.
He's going to go get a suit.
He's going to go to the mall. He's going to hunt down a suit. He's going to buy the first suit he finds. He's going to bring home. I mean, it's a different.
That's a good point. I never thought of it that
way.
It's
really a different approach. But a woman is much more, you know, refined in their shopping methods.
Are you saying us men are barbarians, basically?
Yeah, I'm being very careful because, you know, I'm being extremely careful in how I'm saying any of this. Everything I'm saying is politically.
Really like how I've painted you into a corner.
That's
here?
Right. Now, to date, Pinterest has made no money, but they've mm-hmm. raised $138 million from an A-list roster of investors. So it looks like this is going to be quite successful. And so Ben Silberman and his group, I think, are going to be very successful. Oh, by the way, Ben did marry his girlfriend, and now they have a daughter. That's kind of a sidebar. So there you go. All you want to know about Ben Silberman and Pinterest.
Are you up on Pinterest?
No.
I didn't mean that as in a way to get you in trouble or anything.
Yeah.
No, I've seen it. It's visually, it's very attractive. It's a pretty cool site.
It is. I've looked around Pinterest, and actually you can search for things quite nicely, but I don't really collect pictures like that, so I've not created an account for myself. But I've gone around the thing. It actually is an interesting site, fairly compelling, and it is mostly women who are on it. That is, in fact, the truth.
Yep. Hey, back to the other thing. Looking for keyboards for this thing? Guess where I found one? On Newegg.
Okay.
For $30.
$30.
Not bad.
For
it's
an
a,
iPhone.
It's a Bluetooth wireless keyboard.
For an iPhone?
For an iPhone, yep, indeed.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so I'm going to put that on my Pinterest board, and then when you're looking for Christmas gift ideas for me, you could, you know, select that.
All right.
Or the iPad.
I'll keep that in mind.
Bugging you for. All right, hey, this is Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Hope you're paying attention because knowledge you just gleaned from what Doc was talking about could result in free food. Stay tuned for the pop quiz on Tech Talk on Federal News Radio.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Tech Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Yes, welcome back to the classroom of the airwaves.
That's indeed what it is, and I'm not fighting you on that.
And I hope that you, class, as a class, you have been paying attention and not just sitting there doing text messages during the first part of class. Because if
we're recovering
from
last night, like most students. As you already said.
No, and though you guys sleeping in the back on the back table, you know that's not going to work.
It's not going to work for you.
It's not going to work for you. Okay, if those of you who are listening get the correct answer to the pop quiz, you'll win two tickets to fine dining to Escoffier Dining Room. Plus, you win an A plus for this particular class,
which gets you absolutely nothing.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Now, earlier in the show, I was talking, of course, about Ben Silberman. He was the American internet entrepreneur who co-founded Pinterest. What was his hobby when he was a youth that actually influenced his thinking on Pinterest?
Why, if you have the answer to that question, the only way you can win the prize is to get it to us, and the quickest way is to call us. And this is the point where I tell you, if you're calling from west of Des Moines, Iowa, it's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from east of northwest Washington, it's 877-936-9333. Of course, the wild card line is 877-936-9333.
And those of you listening from Siberia... can reach us by going to on Skype by going to Tech Talk Radio 1, and you simply send a message to that particular account, and that will be forwarded directly to the studio.
You have an advantage by calling us, though.
Yes, I think so. It could be.
All right. Speaking of Skype.
I know. Speaking of Skype, there was a big security breach with Skype a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to talk about kind of how that worked and how they fixed it. Microsoft really scrambled a couple of weeks ago to fix a security vulnerability that allowed somebody to hijack someone else's Skype account with a really simple trick. But if they had listened to a helpful user who reported that bug in the registration system months ago, they could have avoided this whole fiasco. Now, you know, Microsoft owns Skype, and they're not paying attention to these security issues enough. They basically, about a week and a half ago, they disabled all password resets for users so they could fix the problem. And then they brought it back up again. And they decided to disable password resets when the technique was published on Russian websites that showed exactly how anyone can take over someone else's Skype account with just a few easy steps by knowing the email address linked in that account. So what you do is you register a new Skype account using the target's email address. And then by manipulating the applicant's password reset function, anyone can change the password for the target account rather than the new one they've just registered. Because this is the thing. This account takeover technique exploits two oversights of the Microsoft account management system. First, Skype allows anyone to register an account with someone else's email address by failing to verify that that registrant has access to that address. Secondly, it assumes that two accounts with the same email address are linked and gives the same privilege to both accounts from that new user. So simply by using somebody else's email address and registering it, you have access to the person who also used that same email address, and they don't verify.
That's crazy.
It is, and it's really a huge flaw. Now, that was reported months ago by a user and people, and prior to Skype's emergency move to block password resets on Wednesday, there were signs that Skype's security flaws were being used to steal user accounts. Skype's fixed the issue. They did about a year ago. But if you've got a Skype account, I'd recommend that you log on to see whether somebody's taken it and make certain you are still in good condition. Make certain that somebody hasn't changed any of the conditions on it, and the email resets or anything, so that you've got access to that account.
I'm paying furtive attention to Professor Andrew Mitchell, who is talking to some of our possible winners. I want to make sure we get somebody who hasn't won before. We'll do.
Should
this.
I handle the LTE networks? Or are we going to go?
Let's go for it. Let's dive forward, shall we? Let's go to Mark, who is calling from Rockville, Maryland. He is on line number one. Mark, good morning. Welcome to Tech Talk. How are you today?
Well, thank you.
Excellent, Doc. Go ahead and ask the question,
yes,
please.
Yes, earlier in the show, I was talking about Ben Silberman. What hobby did Ben have as a young man that influenced his thinking on Pinterest?
Well, he collected insects and pinned them to a corkboard.
That is correct.
That is very correct and very specific, and thank you, Mark, for listening. So, Doc, tell him what he's won.
You're going to win two tickets to fine dining to the Escoffier Dining Room. And just stay on the line.
That's right.
And give your name and address and email address to Andrew. We'll get the tickets to you next week.
Mark, thanks a lot for listening. Thanks for playing our little game this morning, and stand by for Andrew. This is indeed Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 1035 FM HD2. More Tech Talk coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Let's talk about internet oversight.
Yes.
This is actually an issue that I think, you know, could affect us all, and we want to make certain that it's not not damaged with poor policy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the internet has thrived and grown and been enormously successful without international oversight. It's actually been done through a peer review process. The standards are peer reviewed. It's been very collaborative. And the attitude has been that governments and politics should stay out. It was born out of the belief that open source movements are best, sharing is best, collaboration is best, trusting is best, and out of that environment grew the internet. But now the UN, with all of its politics, is trying to assert more control. The Secretary General of ITU, that would be the International Telegraphic Union, a United Nations agency, said on Monday they're going to try to decide whether they should regulate the internet. Now, the United Nations agency opens this debate on Monday to decide whether this is going to be going to happen or not. Now, the European telecommunications providers want the big content providers to pay to send data across their networks. Also, the African and Arab countries want big content providers to pay to send data across their networks. You see, what's happening, they used to have these exorbitant phone charges,
mm-hmm.
and now people are using the internet. So now they want to have exorbitant internet charges to replace it.
Right.
That would pretty much destroy the internet as we know it. The concept is known as sender pays, and it would radically alter the today's internet economics. Some countries say their networks are groaning under video and other content provided in large part by U.S. companies such as Facebook, Netflix, and Google.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is going to become increasingly a big, big issue. At the conference that begins in Dubai, 193 member countries will decide whether the International Telecommunications Union should somehow start regulating the internet. Now, I don't even know if they have the authority to do that. ITU sets worldwide standards on things like the use of radio spectrum, long-distance telephone calls, but it has not updated its regulations since 1988, and it does not include the internet. Now, that's really, really, we should leave things the way they are, pretty much independent and devoid of government influence. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a position really argued by the U.S. government, and it's also a position shared by Vint Cerf, the original inventor of the internet protocols, along with Bob Kahn. And Cerf now serves for Google as its chief internet evangelist. Cerf asserts that some countries promoting sender pays ideas are simply trying to replace the usurious fees they once gained from state monopoly telecom systems. What they fail to observe is that in the internet model, everyone pays to get on the internet, people at the source and people at the destination. The internet's symmetric. People pay for their access to the internet at both ends, and so the internet is provided both ways. The whole system has evolved into a practical system that works very well at a minimum amount of cost, minimum amount of oversight, and minimum amount of interference due to politics. As proposed by the European telecom companies, a company such as Netflix would have to pay telecom providers to make certain that its bits got delivered fast enough. Now, some of the proposal from Russia and China want greater national control for obviously censorship and other things like that. And the group of 17 Arab countries wants the internet to carry identity information about the senders so they can track them down. None of these things seem to be good ideas for a free and open internet.
No.
I think it would be an extremely, extremely bad idea, and I hope the ITU conference does not try to make that power play. Now, of course, the internet is really managed by the Internet Society, which is working through Department of Commerce here, and there would be, just because they claim they want to control the internet doesn't necessarily mean they can control the internet,
mm-hmm.
and I certainly hope that they stay out of it. The internet really is an example of really quite an impressive government development. It came out of classified work to get a robust network that could sustain a nuclear blast. And Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn managed to get this thing released as open source software. It's a mm-hmm. great accomplishment for the betterment of all mankind. Well, listen, the show is almost over. We love your email. Send a symptom to techtalk@stratford.edu. Also, go to Tech Talk Online. Sign up for the podcast there or sign up for the podcast on Apple iTunes. And make certain to go to stratford.edu and let them know that you heard about Stratford on Tech Talk.
Thanks for listening this week. We'll be back next week on Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
Our Navy coverage shifts from football to basketball today. The midshipmen travel to face Tulane today. The game coverage starts at 2:45 with tip-off at 3 o'clock here on Federal News Radio. The forecast for today, areas of fog, low clouds burning off later on today. Mostly sunny, a high in the mid-50s, currently 39 at 10 a.m.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions.